This is Alan Ramsey interviewing Mary Miro on February 11th, 2008 in the McPhee Center.
Oh, that's all right. That's not a matter. The equipment we had was for physical education classes. That's what we used. Okay. That's what we had to begin somewhere. You know.
Right.
And the gymnastics equipment, in fact, there's nothing in that gym except for one of the floor beams that we originally started with because it changed. That gymnastics equipment changed. It was unbelievable how much it changed just about every other year. We took our own cars. The athletes bought their own uniforms. We traveled all over. Plus, we competed against all of the state universities, including Madison, UW-Milwaukee, and Parkside. All those teams were involved. I don't know if you found anything on that or not.
As far as, pardon me, I'm sorry.
As far as your...
Basically, where I've come to, and I'm trying to get the earlier portion of the story sort of down, and mm-hmm. I'm having a very difficult time with that. Part of the fact, I'm trying to figure out about the Women's Recreation Association, you know, what role did that play per se, and then leading into these, you know, the AIAW, the WWIAC, sort of, you know, that transition point as well.
See, and you only have to ask Judy on that, because she was here before I was, okay. And I don't even know if we had a Women's Recreation Association.
Okay.
We did at the University of Minnesota where I went to school,
okay.
But not here. Not that I even know of. Judy might be able to, because I know we were affiliated with the AIAW mm-hmm. in those first years because
okay.
we have, in fact, the gymnastics team won the first 2 years, the state championship, which was the AIAW state championship.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't even have a WWIAC
yep.
until, that was about 73 when Title IX came in.
Okay.
And when Title IX came in, Judy Crookman became mm-hmm. the women's athletic director.
Yep. Yeah, and I've talked with her some, and I will be actually interviewing her
yeah.
in March. So,
yeah.
And she's trying to figure out about the WRA because we're...
See, and I was upstairs here a while ago, and I was looking at those early trophies. And I did not see anything with Women's Recreation Association on it. And Ida Hans might be able to answer that because she's the one that was here from the beginning
mm-hmm.
of time.
Yeah, and I also talked with her briefly as well, and
she didn't remember either.
She's like, "Well, I really don't know if we kept any records or
there were no records kept until Tim Peterman took over
okay.
the, you know, I mean, we opened up our programs and anybody could come and participate with gymnastics.
Mm-hmm.
I had them from learning front rolls to, you know, very basic.
Mm-hmm.
But in gymnastics, we had three levels of competition, too. We had a beginning level, we had an intermediate level, and we had an advanced level. And all three levels had to do compulsories, but the intermediate advanced did the optionals. The beginning level, they only did compulsory routines and we had to learn those routines and everything in order to teach them to the athletes, you know. So the Women's Recreation Association, I honestly don't know.
Okay.
Because the AIAW was that affiliation, because that's was the state meet we had that first 2 years. I just looked at the trophy here about a month ago, and yeah, on it, it had AIAW on it. It wasn't WWIAC or that wasn't it. Our affiliation was the AIAW. So that much I know. So I don't recall Women's Recreation Association at all. And it might have been before I came.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. And I didn't know when exactly.
Yeah, and Judy might. And if she can't remember, then we didn't have it.
Okay.
It wasn't here. Yeah, because I don't ever recall when I came here that we were affiliated with the Women's Recreation Association, because it was AIW.
Okay.
That's all I can remember. And then we went to the NAIA, as the part of ours was the NAIA, National Association of Intercollegiate Athletics. And that happened, let me think. Was that 1981? Could have been. I gotta think. I was the national sports chair for the NAIA. In 82-83, we were at an NAIA national tournament in Massachusetts, and Nancy Baker from Gustavus asked me if I'd be interested in being the national sports chair for the NAIA for gymnastics. So I went to the national convention 4 years in a row. And, yeah, because then by 1987-88, some of the colleges that competed in those NAIA National Gymnastics Tournaments, they dropped their programs, and then the NCAA, you had two affiliations, you could go to NAIA or NCAA. Well, then eventually NAIA dropped gymnastics totally. They dropped a lot of sports, and we went NCAA. And then in that whole process, the NCGA, the National Collegiate Gymnastics Association, was formed in the 80s.
Okay.
And that was formed by Nancy Baker and Mary Jane Olson in the Minnesota. And that still continues to go because it was strictly for non-scholarship schools. And the only way Winona could even be part of this NCGA, my understanding, is over the last 4 or 5 years they had to drop their scholarships,
okay.
academic scholarships for their women gymnasts. That's what they had to do in order to be affiliated.
Yeah,
so.
I was going to say, I've heard of the NCGA.
Yeah.
It's been mentioned.
So that's been going a long time, and they had the foresight to see if we don't form, if we didn't form the NCGA, there would be, there's no... there's no NCAA division, what do I want to say? There's no Division III national tournament, and there's no Division II, it's only Division I. And the only way a Division III gymnast, they'd have to qualify, their scores would have to be so high, and there's only been one or two, one here and one at Oshkosh, who've made it to that NCAA tournament. So, yeah, I mean... And not every gymnast is, not every athlete's going to be an NCAA Division I.
No.
You know. There isn't that much money there anyway. You know, I mean, there's a lot of money, but it becomes a job. It doesn't become... Our philosophy here is that they're to get a degree and you get them out of school and you want to graduate them, so...
Right, right.
Any other questions that you might have had that you...
I guess I want to sort of go back a little bit to... sort of your interest in athletics, how did that begin for you?
Oh, I was very young. I was just a kid. And it began because my dad was quite an athlete. My dad had a scholarship at St. Thomas College in football and basketball. And then when we were kids, my dad started us swimming when we were babies. We're all very good swimmers. And I became interested in really sports when I was in seventh grade. I was up at a playground and they had a speed skating race one Sunday afternoon. I thought, oh, I'll just enter the race. I had figure skates on. So I thought, oh, I'll enter the race. Well, I got these figure skates on and I entered the race. I won the darn thing. So I had to compete out. They had a, they call it an all-city speed skating championships at Como Park. So I won that race, and I told my mom and dad, I said, I won the race at this thing, and I have to compete at Como Park. And I said, I don't think I can do very well in figure skates. I really need to get a pair of speed skates. So, and for my mom and dad, my dad, until he retired, he made $5,000 a year. That's what he made. And so they bought me a pair of speed skates, and I won that. And then it's kind of the interest that I got. And then I began being a swimmer. When I was in seventh grade, I was down at a swimming pool We paid 5 cents, cost a nickel to go in and swim for an hour, and I was diving on the diving board, I was putzing around. This lifeguard came over and said, "Would you be interested in being on our girls' swimming and diving team?" And I go, "Well, I don't know, I'll talk it over with my mom, you know." So I talked it over with my folks, and when I went back, I said, "Yeah, I will." Well, I just found out here in 2001, we had a reunion of all of the kids that, all of us on the swimming team, about 65 of us. I found out I was the first one on the swimming team, and I was the only diver for 5 years. And my competitive years in diving went all the way through college. I won the Minnesota AAU Indoor Outdoor Swimming and Diving Championships 5 years in a row, 1 meter and 3 meter diving. I did a lot. But I also got involved in a lot of other sports. And when I went on to get my master's degree at the University of Minnesota, or my bachelor's degree at the University of Minnesota, I took badminton class. I took every kind of PE class I could because it was really my interest. We didn't have athletics in high school at all. You know, that was from 55 to 59, there was no athletics. My junior year, I had found out that there was going to be an all-city girls high school swimming meet. So I got a bunch of my high school gals together, and we formed a team, you know. And that's kind of how things got started. We were all pioneers in our field, you know. I was a tomboy. They wouldn't call me that today. But that's what they called us back then. We were just tomboys, you know. I get ridiculed by neighbors. "Oh, you're such a tomboy, and you should be playing with dolls and all of that." And I go, "Oh, the heck with the dolls, you know. Jeez, who wants to play with dolls? You know, I played football and baseball with the boys in the neighborhood. There were no girls to play with." So, you know. And my dad, my dad taught us all how to hunt. We did a lot of hunting, and I still do. I took up deer hunting when I retired from turkey hunting. So that's kind of how it evolved, you know, just the interest in sports, and it's been my life.
You mentioned going to college. When was that, and what did you mentioned you took all these physical education classes, so were you into the physical education major, or did you do something else?
No, my major was in recreation leadership, which was a program. Was the only, University of Minnesota was the only school in the United States university or college that had this degree. And it was developed by Dr. Gerald B. Fitzgerald, who wrote a book on recreation leadership in 1955. I still have that textbook. I've kept that one. And it's a field where you can go into any role, like city recreation or parks and recreation. You can go into YMCA, YWCA. You can go into Campfire Girls, Girl Scouts, but it all deals with the recreation field, even university recreation. I mean, that was part of that whole process. And so I went into that field because I had a great interest in it. And there were no athletic teams at the University of Minnesota at that time. I joined a tumbling club. That's what we had. And in 1950, I think, 59-60, the fall of 1960, we had a women's athletic association there at the University of Minnesota. And you could earn your letter, and you could earn bars, like some of the guys get, for so many hours that you put in and things like that. And we had a play day. We invited all the colleges, universities, women to come to that play day. And that's where I met Sue Day and Joyce Locks from Winona State University. I met them there, and great women. And they became part of the process when we decided to form a Wisconsin Women's Intercollegiate Athletic Conference. They came here, and we brought in coaches and ADs from around the state, and we met here for a day. And we had a conference, and they shared. There were three or four women from Minnesota, and those two women came. They shared with us the do's and don'ts. If you're going to do a conference, don't do this and this and this, because from what they experienced, we avoided that. We had the strongest conference, actually, really one of the strongest conferences in the country for a Division III school. So that's how that all began. There was no...
Right, and what year roughly did you graduate from college?
Oh, I graduated my bachelor's in 1963.
Okay.
And my master's in 68. And when I did my master's in 68, the department chair, the fall of 67, she asked me, the fall of 67, the department chair called me in her office. She says, would you be interested in starting a women's gymnastics team? They had nothing, even then. I said, sure, I'll be glad to. So I did. So I was really the first women's gymnastics coach there. And started that gymnastics team. From there, when I was only there a year, and then I went back to St. Teresa's for a year, and then after that year I came here.
And where did you start the gymnastics team at?
At the University of Minnesota.
Okay.
And it's College of St. Teresa's. They had no women's athletics. They had 1,000 women living on campus, and I became the recreation director. They all thought I was a freshman when I got there. And who are you? You must be a new freshman. I go, no, I'm your recreation director. Oh, you know, they got a little embarrassed because I looked like them. I was only a year older than some of them. I was same age. But, so I went down there, and they had no Women's Athletic Association. They had no intramural programs, no athletics at all. And I've started all of that down there and for 5-6 years. And then I left there, and I came here because there was a job opening here for gymnastics and diving and teaching. All of us women, by the way, when we came here, all of the women who coached athletics in those early years, all of us women were hired as teachers in physical education. The athletics was an added entity that was not in the job description. Where the men, when they were hired here, they were hired to coach athletics, whatever sport it was, and to teach. So the women had a different contract than the men. We didn't get athletics attached to our contracts till 19, had to be 76, 77. So it was all gratis.
Okay. So, what year did you come to Eau Claire then, if I'm trying to...
1969.
Okay.
Fall of 69.
And what, and I know you've sort of elaborated on it, but what, just to refresh, what was here at the time for women exactly as far as sport, athletics? Was there anything, or was it just...
There was nothing.
Okay.
My understanding is the year before I came, Ida... They had some kind of a gymnastics get-together, I think at Stout or something like that. I found an article on it. And it was just some of the colleges got together and they had a gymnastics kind of like, I don't know if it was a meet or what it was. But there was really no athletics.
Okay.
And Sandy Schumacher may have done something with some of the sports that year before, but I mean, we really didn't. The focus wasn't really on developing an athletics program until that time.
Okay. What did you teach here as far as physical education is concerned?
You really don't want the list, do you? Because it goes this long.
Oh.
I've taught all kinds of sports activities. And then I taught dance, and I, you know, taught ballet, modern dance, some of those things with the dance company. When Alice Ganzel had the dance company, and then when Tony Poole Sorensen came, 3 years afterwards, I just phased myself out and gave it to her, and she moved it down into fine arts. We all taught lots of different physical education classes. My real strong area was swimming. I taught beginning swimming, intermediate swimming. I taught diving, taught synchronized swimming. And then, of course, I taught all of the gymnastics classes. We had beginning and intermediate level classes. We had what they call rhythmic gymnastics. I don't know if you're familiar with that, where they do the balls and the ribbons and things.
Okay.
I taught bowling. I taught archery. I taught badminton, tennis. Oh, my Lord. And then Ed Olson and Frank Wigglesworth, my first year here, they taught skiing on this little hill out here. And so I ended up teaching downhill and cross-country skiing for 30 years. And when I retired, the classes no longer exist. So when those two retired, I just took over the ski classes and continued their legacy. You know, so, yeah. So I taught a lot. Plus, methods courses. We were all involved in teaching methods courses. And our philosophy here at that time with the men and the women in the department was we focused on lifetime sports. We wanted classes here in those sports that we know that students could take in their lifetime sport. We had fishing classes. We had hunting classes, you know, archery. Oh, my gosh. Our gym was busy from 8 in the morning till 3 in the afternoon till sports came in. So, yeah, times have changed. And you know, even with the sports, when we first started, the men's athletic program had priority over the times and the use of the facility before the women, by the way. They had that for quite a few years. If we had the women's gymnastics team, the men were in the gym first, and it was a priority. And then the women couldn't get in the gym to work out from, we worked out from 6 to 8 in the evening. When Title IX came in, Bob Scott at the time was a coach, and I said, you know, Bob, we need to share facilities here. I said, it's kind of senseless. I said, when your guys are in tumbling, the women can do the equipment. And but we had, eventually, we just kind of merged the guys and the gals, and we had the women doing the tumbling with the guys, and we shared the equipment, and we were all in the facility at the same time, you know, and that's just kind of the way we worked it. But it wasn't that way with basketball. I can tell you that.
What was the difference there then?
Well, Ken Anderson was here at the time, and he had priority, and then the women practiced when he wasn't. There was going to be no give there, I can tell you that. Yeah, times have changed. Bill Meiser took over. Actually, Bill Meiser brought in track and field when he came here to Eau Claire, but he was our first athletic trainer. Bill Meiser was. He started the whole athletic. When they moved in, this building spring of 69. I came in fall of 69. They had the athletic training room. Bill Meiser was the first athletic trainer, and the athletic training room was for men only. The women were not allowed in that room until 1973, when Title IX came in. Then that opened up the doors for the women.
Was there any specific reason given for why it wasn't open? Or just
it was just the way it was. And we didn't push it. But once Title IX came in, that just changed everything. So, yeah. And then there were women that were doing athletic training. He was training women then. He started training women, doing athletic training and things like that. And it was wonderful to have a trainer when you go to a meet. We took our trainers with us. They traveled with us. We'd have one trainer and made sure that these trainers knew how to tape gymnasts. You don't tape a gymnast's ankle like you do for somebody who's going to put on a football shoe, you know,
in
those types of things. And so we all had to learn. You know, we all had to work together and learn. So that's what we did.
Let's see. Were you involved in any of the meeting stages of decisions or regarding Title IX? Or what was the sort of the atmosphere? You sort of alluded to that beforehand. It was sort of, you know, men had more priority over female, you know, workouts and so forth.
Well, that's just the way it was. If you didn't rock the boat, or you'd be on the... It's just the way it was. We didn't rock the boat. And I don't know, Judy, my be able to allude to that a little more, but even the swimming team, the men's swimming team were in the pool, you know, first, but I think she kind of weaned in the women coming in, and then eventually when, before she left here to become our commissioner, Tom Pryor took over the swimming team, and it became quite, in fact, our classes before Title IX, we had all of these classes for men. Every class that the women had, the men had, but they were separate. They were separate. And when, in 73, when that Title IX came in, funny part is, we had a major in physical education. We could not get the major approved. It took 10 years for Ida Hans and Ada Olson to get the physical education major approved. When it was approved, it was for women only. It's the only way we could get a physical education major here. And Ida and Ada worked on that for 10 years to get that major here. Because we had that WICWIC consortium with La Crosse and River Falls Stout and us, and I just couldn't get it passed. And when Title IX came in, that major came in, and then the men eventually, the major, we just put the men in about 1975, 76. The door was just open. And we all talked about, why are we duplicating these classes? We're duplicating everything. You know, same amount of swimming classes for men, for women. Then everything merged and we just became co-ed. And it was foolish. You know, it was a waste of a lot of people's time, you know, could be doing other things. So, yeah.
So was it a smooth transition during Title IX, or was it?
It wasn't.
Was it rough?
No, it wasn't at all. You know, I think the rough part was getting that major here, and you know, and the men in gymnastics. We had a men's gymnastics team here at the same time, but then they folded the collegiate gymnastics for men folded in 76, 77, 78, right around there. They all dropped their programs.
So, any specific reason?
Well, you know, I don't know if it was because of the equipment or what. I have no idea. But I do know this. Women's gymnastics, there were 450 high schools. I know there were 450 high schools in the state that had girls' gymnastics. And the number of colleges, I don't know how many hundreds of colleges had it. And they're down under less than 75 in the United States. And part of the problem is because the sport, you look at the sport of gymnastics where we were with front rolls on the balance beam and back rolls, and now they're doing twisters on the beam and things like that. People who were in gymnastics could not keep up with the change because the change was so fast every year. It was tough to keep up with just the skills of learning how to coach them and spotting them. We didn't have that. Crash pads we have nowadays. We did all of the lifting ourselves with assistant coaches. So, yeah. But the transition was smooth. I mean, it wasn't really any biggie. It was a great thing that ever happened, though, because it sure opened up the doors. You know, we didn't have a golf team for women, so Mary Iverson, she was on the men's golf team, and it took a while to get that permission. And Judy can tell you about that. Rosemary Iverson. And she became the first woman to ever play golf for Eau Claire, but she was on the men's team. Didn't have a women's team? She had every right to compete.
So in general, as far as department-wise, sort of smooth, but there was definite rough spots, so to speak, then?
Oh, yeah. You know, it's typical in any institution, you know. You get a focus like this, and it's hard for some people to get away from this. You know? You got to be broad-minded, and I think the women kind of stood up for rights. I know before I retired, they were going to bring in the women's hockey team, and I voted against it. I voted against having a women's hockey team, because I sat in the meeting, and I said, we can't take care of the sports we already have. We can't afford the sports we already have. I know just from gymnastics with the cost of equipment. why are we going to bring in another team? And now we're going to narrow down, and you're going to drain even more and more and more. Well, and that was a couple of years after that that they got independent. I don't know if it was independent funding for it or what, but yeah, I mean, you can't bring in more sports when you haven't got the money to take care of what you already have. And gymnastics is expensive. For a piece of equipment, it's unbelievable what it costs to replace.
What was your, I know you alluded to budget, what was your, do you know what your specific budget at first was when you came for gymnastics?
$700 for all of the women's sports. We didn't have a budget, we didn't even have a budget. There was $700 there for women's athletics, and you have to figure out how you're going to use $700. So the athletes bought all their own uniforms. My gymnasts bought their leotards, and we hand-decorated them. You know, we did whatever was creative, you know. And then they bought, when we had our actual team leotards, they bought their own leotards. They bought their own gymnastic shoes. We drove our own cars. Of course, that wouldn't be allowed now, you know, until Title IX came in, and then Title IX changed a lot of that. Then they had to come up with a budget for women's athletics, and Title IX really made that change. You know, I mean, it was dangerous having athletes driving their own cars, and, you know, with winter around here. And then we finally started getting vans and things where we drive them as groups. So.
And do you know, in general, and this has been sort of a curiosity of mine, I'm sure I can dig through archival materials, but do you know what the sort of the campus climate when Title IX sort of became apparent that these changes were coming? Was it pretty quiet, or was there a lot of opinions about the changes?
No, I don't know, because, you know, we're kind of away from down there.
Okay.
But we had a chancellor that was very supportive, and I think that made a difference too. But we still had the good old boys club. I hate to tell you, and that good old boys club is still trying to have control. And they're all retired. They're still trying to control things, I understand. So I'm going, oh man, let go of it, you know. But yeah, you know, it's just, I know the men were concerned because it would take money away from them and that kind of stuff, but we were pressured, and I don't even know if we were in the guidelines in the 1990s.
Okay.
Equal? I don't know. I doubt it in some things. But, you know, hopefully it's gotten better.
Okay.
I was kind of out of the loop after I was taken out of gymnastics in 1990. I'll tell you, if I had to pay for every surgery I had, would have cost me, I don't know, close to $100,000 for all of the joints I've had to have done a repair because of the sport itself. It took its toll on me, and it does on gymnastics anyway, it does, because we were doing all of the lifting, you know. I mean, we did it all. And everybody was bigger than me, you know. Our biggest problem was getting equipment and stuff, and getting, we had to have, it was mandated, we had to have equipment up to date. So I when I came here, I started the gymnastics camps here. I did it for 30 years. And there were quite a few years there that I never got a nickel. I took anything left over, and I bought equipment for the gymnastics gym. That's how we got our equipment.
Even after Title IX?
Even after Title IX. Women's athletics made very little contribution to specifically gymnastics equipment. And then when Judy left, and our AD now took over, if we had any money left over in our account at the end of our season, it was gone. And next year we started from scratch again. So I thought, oh my gosh. So any money I had left over, I'd buy another vaulting board, or I'd have to get another balance beam, or whatever I had to do. I had to get equipment out of that money if I didn't use it, you know.
So there was no possibility of carryover from year to year in funding?
I still don't think it's there. I really don't know. You'd have to ask Marilyn, but I don't know. I don't think so. I think in the camps they have to be self-sustaining. So we got some coaches here that are making nice money. I'll be frank with you. Some of them are almost making as much off the camps as I did teaching here for a year. Yeah. I don't want to talk about that. It's amazing. Well, we have coaches here that are making more money than people who have their PhDs teaching.
Yeah, that seems to be a not only here but national trend of seems to be higher up and further up you are the
highest paying person in this department should be Tim Peterman. If anybody has been here 40 some years. He was a student sophomore when I came here. So he should be the highest paying person in this department. With all he's done? I know he isn't. But he's nowhere near some of the coaches either, I'm sure. They're making more than him.
Let's see. Is there any specific time where you faced a challenge as a coach in gymnastics or as a physical education teacher that you just didn't know if it was going to work out, or was there some point that was just the most challenging as far as career-wise here?
The most challenging thing for me was my last 85 to 90. Those last 5 years were the most difficult years for me because of the physical problems I was having. Like, you know, if I wasn't on crutches, I was in a cast. If I wasn't in the cast, I was in a brace. Because the sport that I was coaching was beginning to take a toll on my physical. I had a lot of injuries from the athletes. I mean, I got hurt, you know. Mm-hmm. Nothing I can do about it, but I got hurt. And then my knees got so bad. And doing this motion that I did for 21 years, the year that I was asked to see if I could be, a surgeon asked me if I could get out of coaching, and I says, I don't know, I'll ask. I asked one person, this person says, talk to this person. That person turned around and told me to talk to the person that just told me to talk to. So it wasn't going to happen. So I went back to my surgeon, and I said, they aren't going to let me out of coaching. Well, within a month, they got a letter, and they had to take me out of coaching. And I still have a copy of that letter. If they don't take me out of coaching, within a year, I'm going to have this particular surgery. I was taken out of coaching, and that fall, I had that particular surgery. It was less than a year. It wasn't even a year. It was 4 months later. I had to have an osteotomy done on my left knee, where they amputate the leg. They actually amputate it, and then they realign it. And I've had two knee replacements since. So, yeah, total knees. And I'm pain-free. When I go back and look in the 90s there, at the end there, I had, from rotating so much, I went bow-legged. So I had raw bone, rubbing legged. So I'm raw bone on raw bone, which is like having somebody take a match and put it in the joint and light it and leave it burn 24 hours. I had that for almost 20 years. I'm pain-free now, and I'm running on the treadmill. My legs are straight. I'm doing stuff I haven't done in over 20 years. So, yeah, those last 5 years, physically, I was in so much pain. I can't explain. Even teaching my bicycling classes were tough. But I did them, you know. But it'd take me a mile to warm up, and then my knees were pretty good. And then when I got off, and then I walked like a penguin so bad. I walked like a penguin. Did you notice I went down the steps a little slow? Because I've actually lost degrees in my knee bend.
Okay.
Yeah. So, some physical issues there. I love coaching. I mean, I loved teaching. I loved up till the day I retired. I loved teaching. In fact, I'm back in the workforce. I'm at the senior center now. I'm helping people on equipment in the fitness center. So I'm kind of back in the workforce the last couple months. It's kind of fun.
Let's see here. Was there any particular role that Eau Claire played within the state that you would know of as far as pushing women's athletics, or were most institutions at the same time pushing it, or did Title IX basically force that push? Was there any institution that you would know of, and maybe not, you know, sort of, I've tended to notice in some ways that some institutions sort of took a, you know, we want to do this, you know, and the other ones sort of okay. And I just was curious if Eau Claire played any role in formation, or if it's pretty much an even field.
With the sport of gymnastics, we played a major role. I did clinics all over the state with my athletes. We went all over the state. We did clinics for high schools, and we were down in Little Gilmanton, you know, and we did gymnastics clinics all over. We did demonstrations. I had an IT. We were all over. And we did a lot of clinics here. The major role, I'll tell you just with gymnastics, we had the first gymnastics, all girls gymnastics. Actually, the first girls. Let me put it this way. We were the first girls' sports camp here. We had them here. Sandy Schumacher had basketball, and I had gymnastics. Nobody else in the state had them. So we were the forerunner in sports of gymnastics and basketball. Then the rest of them started doing them. But as far as pushing, I think we were in the ballpark. We were in the ballpark with Stevens Point, even, you know, Stevens Point dropped some sports, but we had just our without Madison and Parkside and Milwaukee. I think our institution here had a big role, along, and lacrosse too, but lacrosse wasn't doing. I don't think they were doing what we were doing here, and just with the camps. I don't even know. Lacrosse didn't have a gymnastics camp. I know they didn't. And we did a lot of clinics. Oh, my gosh. And I brought in Nancy Baker from Gustavus Adolphus. She brought her athletes, and she did clinics here. And, I think our institution here had a big role in it. Sandy Schumacher. With our teams, you know, we all worked hard. You know, we taught. For credit hours, we all taught 28, 29 credit hours along with coaching. Now, if they teach 12 credit hours, they got it made here. They haven't got a clue what they got. We were about 28 hours a semester. We did a full load of teaching, and then we coached.
Was there any given time for coaching? Was that on your own?
Well, that we weren't paid for it. This is what we wanted to do, is we wanted to get things rolling here. So we just did it. Bunch of diehards. But we were all pioneers. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've had high school classmates tell me, do you know you're a pioneer as a kid in athletics and all that? And I go, yeah, I know. You know, somebody's got to start it. Somebody mm-hmm. just has to do it, you know. We all got along, the women. Got along, and the men too, and and Sandy Schumacher would be a good one, because she was state champion in badminton when she was young. She was also, I still remember the day that she pitched a softball to one of my gymnasts, was taking her softball class it was a softball class she would do, and I happened to walk out there and watch it, and in fact, Becky Zomer is here down in the, she's down in, not admissions, but she's down in one of the offices down there. And she's ready to catch the ball, and Schumacher takes it. She rolls one and lets her have it. All of a sudden, bang, and here's Becky. Oh, she's looking at the net. Oh, my God, it stung so bad that she took the glove off. She had all her fingers frantically. It was so funny. Oh, Sandy was unbelievable athlete. Just really great. Yeah. So we all had a role. You know, Ida Hinz became the department chair. And Ida is the one who, even though she never coached, she just felt, this is what we have to do. These are things we have to do, you know, to get athletics going. And never disagreed. She was really a leader in a quiet way. Uh-huh. You know. So, yeah. And Judy Krippman was great to work for. She was great to work for. She's a great AD. I was sad when she went down to the commission, but I thought, well, she'll do a good job down there, and she has. She's just done a wonderful job down there, too. So, you know, you hate to see somebody leaving, but she had a greater opportunity and more power to her.
trying to think here. So, when about did Coach release time occur for coaching? What? How long after the passage of Title IX?
Oh, I gotta think on that one. Oh, man. That'd have to be in the 80s to give us release time. Because we still, even up to 1990 when I was coaching, I was still teaching a heavy load. You know, I couldn't. I know how you could find that out, though. You can go down to the registrar's office and they could give you what the loads were for, you know, because they can look it up. They've got it all on the statistics of it. But you can go down there in the registrar's office at registration, and the only reason I know is because they were able to give me the courses that I taught. They have all of that documentation of what courses we taught. And I think the release time, we got a little bit of release, but it really didn't come about, though. It was years after Title IX. Well, we didn't get paid until 76, maybe. You know, and it wasn't a lot.
So compliance took time.
Oh yeah, we weren't in compliance. I'm sure we weren't in compliance even when I was out of coaching in 1990. It's better now than it was, but we were never really exactly in compliance. It wasn't equal to the men. And if the men say it was, sorry, it wasn't equal. Yeah.
Okay.
Marilyn might be able to answer some of that for you. Mm-hmm. But
yeah, I'm just curious about, you know, if it was compliant or not, what opportunities were available before and after, mm-hmm. sort of seeing, you know, what changes occurred, you know, what was open and not so much open, what changes occurred. So I'm trying to look at both.
Well, I think the biggest change for the men was that they couldn't have the prime times all the time. Had to do some sharing of the prime time, because the prime time is 3 to 5 o'clock. That's the prime time. And with hockey, you know, they have to work their schedules around because of ice time. I mean, that whole ice time is just a real big issue. And that was one of the reasons I didn't vote for hockey, because I knew what the ice cost was. I had a real tough time with that when we couldn't get equipment in the gymnastics gym.
What was the reason for the push for, was it to make it?
Well, we had a club. We had a club. You know, we had a club in we had a soccer club, and we had a hockey club, and when you start getting these clubs coming in, Well, all of a sudden, these clubs kind of came into the athletic portion of it because they were becoming so popular, and that's how some of those came in. And but as far as time and things, we worked it out in gymnastics, you know, and then when the men dropped the program, it wasn't, you know, I mean, we worked it out. You know, you just, but you get some people, right? No way I'm going to give up my time, and that's just who you were working with, you know.
Was there a specific reason the men's gymnastics program quit? Was it due to lack of interest, or?
It was due to the lack of the lack of teams within the state,
okay.
Because it was small anyway, and yeah, just that. Well, when we started with gymnastics, every state university, all colleges and universities, we all had gymnastics team. Stevens Point dropped theirs, Madison dropped theirs, Milwaukee Park dropped theirs, Parkside dropped theirs. And then recently, the last one now is River Falls. And the coach from River Falls is now here, and that's Gene Delisle, because River Falls dropped their program. So, yeah, I mean, that's, and part of it is, that's the decision that they make, and, you know, it's, part of it is that equipment and having people who have the knowledge of the sport, because, boy, you sure got to know what you're doing when you're coaching that, you know, I always told everybody I was coaching physics. What do you mean you're coaching physics? And I'm going, well, I'm coaching Newton's laws and levers. Yeah, what? You know, I coach Newton's laws and levers. You know, you got to understand that whole area of, because it is, it's really physics and a lot of things that they're doing. And gymnastics changes every 4 years, the rules. It changes with every Olympic. Our women compete the Olympic rules. So now new rules will come in after this year, summer, and then every 4 years, it's like, oh my gosh, and then it's like, okay, now you gotta, things change, and it changes because
that's,
of the Olympics.
That's the that's just
the rules that they go by, the okay. Rules as far as competition and how many, what are your skills, you know, what's if you did a triple-triple, and, you know, I mean, that's how it works. As the Olympics bring in new skills, that changes the sports and the rule. And the Olympics are the ones that kind of dictate what we do in the college level. And our college students they compete Olympic gymnastics rules.
Has anyone ever attempted to go to the Olympic level qualifying-wise? Or is that
Never.
Is that something left to the bigger?
Well, men's gymnastics, your Olympic team is made up of college men gymnasts. And the reason it is because the men's bodies don't fully develop until they're in those early 20s. It takes that long. Gymnastics for women, if you're 20 years old, you're over the hill. You watch 14, 15, 16, 17-year-olds. It's kind of like figure skating. Is getting that way. I just watched the USA Championships. There's a 14-year-old and a 15-year-old, and neither one qualify
right.
for the world
next,
or whatever.
Yes.
Yeah. So that's just how
it's just
it
a
works.
Physiological difference.
That whole physiology is part of it because a man, when they do five events, their body maturity. And the strength isn't there until they're 20, 22, 23, 24. They're already in those early adult years. They're not mature. Their bodies are built at the age of 18. If you ever look in an Olympic gymnast, they're all over 20. And that's just the nature of the beast. The men are strength. The women are strength, too. But the women are swing types of strength.
It's
the only best way I can explain it.
Okay, I was just curious, you know, if they, yeah. College, at the college level, if they, you know, because you hear that with some of the previous Olympic sports, not so much with some of them anymore, but the college, you know, that you go through the qualifyings to make it.
Well, better. Girls are from clubs. Mm-hmm. Women's gymnastics, they're club gymnasts. Very rarely do they have a college gymnast, but occasionally we have. But the men are club or mainly college gymnasts. That's where they come from. That's the difference.
Do you remember any of the compliance or discussions department-wise, or were you sort of outside looking in on all that? Or were you within the discussions based around Title IX compliance?
Oh, all of them. We were all in on that. We were all in on that. Absolutely. To get that compliance. And talking with the men. And when we had a department meeting, it was everybody. We didn't have a separate academic meeting and a separate athletic meeting like they have now, because everybody coached, everybody taught. It was the name of the game. So we were all part of that. You know, and how do you get things in compliance? And I mean, it wasn't a we don't want it or we want it type thing. It wasn't that way. It was just, how were we going to come in compliance? And we knew they gave you several years to come into compliance. And the biggest problem was coming in compliance was equipment, clothing, you know, money for coaches. I think my raise was $1,000 the first year I coached. That I got paid, something like that. It wasn't very much. The women were never equal to the men, though, when it came to pay.
Just the way it was?
Just the way it was.
Some
of us got pay raises because of our teaching. We got excellence in teaching. I got an excellence in teaching pay raise many times. Because it was teaching.
So there was no... I'm not trying to press, but there's like no heated, you know, I'm not going to give this up versus I want this sort of thing, or large pushes like that. Just sort of.
The men knew that they had to somehow come into compliance. Okay. Part of coming in compliance was promoting women too, from instructors to assistant professors to associates to professors. Mm-hmm. That was part of some of the compliance I had to come into, because that wasn't happening here either.
So that the academic side was also playing in then.
Well, that's all. Yeah, you got the academic side. You got all men that are serving on all of these committees, and there's no women. You think the women have a chance? No. So, yeah. And that was even in the 80s, 90s, even in the 90s.
So based on the more of a physical education side of things, you had these discussions, or was...
Well, you got physical education, had those discussions, so there's equal opportunity for the women to get promoted. And then you had the athletic opportunities, too. You know, my gymnast asked me, I can still remember, was my team, my group that went to, first time we ever went to nationals. And... the whole team came walking in the gym at the same time. And I thought, here we go. They got something up their sleeve, you know. We need to talk to you. Okay. We want to know why we can't have bags like the swimming team, or why we can't have jackets like the swimming team, or if we can have this and have that. And at that time, I had assistant coaches, which I had to pay out of my budget, okay, because I had to have men coaches in there, and I trained them all. They didn't come in with experience. It took me 2 years to get them trained. And then they graduated. And so, you know, they had discussed it over. And I said, well, this is my question to you. And I'll leave here after I ask the question. I'll go into my office. When you're done discussing, come on and get me. And I said, I want you to tell me how many assistant coaches you want me to release and which ones. That's my question. And I walked out of the gym and I went into my office. About 2 minutes later, they brought me back in and they go, "We don't want you to get rid of any of the coaches. Forget the bags. Forget the jackets." I says, "Well, that's the choice you have." Because they knew we had to have the men helping us because of all of the spotting you have to do and everything. And you got 4 events going. You've got to have, you had to have that help. I just absolutely had to have that help. And I had to train them. And a couple I sent up to the cities to get training up there and just working a couple times. We paid their way. You know, took care of whatever it took in gas and stuff so they could go out and get some hands-on training because it's, you know, I had some people here who said, "Oh, just take anybody off the street and have them come in." And I go, "Yeah, and they'll kill a gymnast." You know, I said, "Who's going to pay for the funeral? Who's going to pay for the lawsuit?" You know, let's be practical. Because it takes a long time to learn how to spot. When do you spot? You know, that's again, that's that physics thing. It's all timing, you know. So that's what I did. Gave him a choice. "Don't need the bags, coach." "Okay." You know, we didn't start buying leotards for the team until, it was about 77, 78, by the team leotards and warm-ups. In fact, we had a set of warm-ups that all of the teams used because our sports went like basketball, gymnastics was a fall sport. Then they were done. Or volleyball and gymnastics. Then we had basketball, swimming and diving was a winter sport. Then we had track and field, and we had softball in the spring. So, I mean, they were seasonal sports. They weren't a year-round sport. Once the gymnasts were done, they were done. Then I was in diving, coaching diving. Well, to keep the gymnasts in condition, I had open gym, and then in the spring we would do a gymnastrata every year. So we do a complete gymnastics show. I had all the gymnasts do things on the different pieces of equipment, and then we did a lot of innovative things, and it was great. We packed them in here. We packed people in here because they just, you know, it was just a fun thing to do. We did that for years until we started to go to nationals in 82, 83, and then I go, "We can't do this anymore. We just got to focus on getting to nationals." And, you know, so yeah, very costly.
Was by getting to nationals, was there any sort of
you had to qualify.
Okay.
You had qualifications. You had to qualify as a school, and at that time, our first nationals, we went as a team. We went to Georgia, and our team qualified. So it was based on the NCGA. That was our first NCGA nationals. We went to Georgia. And was that NAIA? No, that was NAIA. But we had the NCGA affiliation with that. And we went to Georgia, and of course, I had to pay for all of the expenses and everything, get everything paid. And we ended up staying at they had a outdoor recreation facility that was, I don't know how many acres they had. And I called Giza Martini. His name was Giza Martini. He was the gymnastics coach at Parkside. And I called him and I says, "Giza, have you got a place that you can put my gymnast and I up at that isn't going to cost us an arm and a leg?" He goes, "Yeah, we have a facility outside of town here. We'll let you have it. It won't cost you anything." So we stayed there and then we went shopping, we got food, and we fixed our meals there and everything. And the city does money. You know, so that's what we did. And we had a good time. Kids had fun, you know. So, it's lots of changes. It's amazing.
Did nationals bring any extra attention that you needed, more equipment, or was it just, okay, well, you made it to nationals and sort of a more of a congratulatory tone?
No, I think that was kind of the eye-opener in the 80s. Then they realized, like, oh, you have to stay up to date on equipment. Uh-huh. And then it became mandated. It became mandated by the, through the Olympic Committee and that kind of stuff. things started to become mandated. We had to have certain equipment. Your mat has to be so big. You have to have everything is by measurement, all of that. You had to have the right equipment in order to even compete on it. And we had to get rid of uneven bars and get the legal equipment in because of safety is part of it. You know, they don't have the issues on bars like we used to. In fact, the first set of bars, I can tell you, here's the low bar, and the high bar's here, okay. You know, up. That bar, I'm not kidding you, didn't go any farther out than about this distance. That was it. That's all the width they had between the high bar and the low bar. I mean, it was longer this way. But I mean, for the actual width distance, that's all the farther the bars came apart. So you couldn't do an awful lot on something like that. Plus, they did easy stuff. But then as things got harder, the bars became wider and wider to the point now. I mean, I couldn't even jump from the low bar to get the high bar, you know, because of the giants and things they do. Because men's high bar then became part of women's uneven bars. So, yeah. And even that vaulting tongue, I call it the vaulting table, looks like a tongue to me. That came in, when did that accident happen? A gal from China was vaulting. And she did a round off onto the vaulting board. And when she did that round off to go backwards, when she went up, she missed the horse and fell between the board and the horse and landed and broke her neck. She's quadriplegic. I happened to be watching with my daughter. It was a world championships, and I said, you watch. Within a short time, they're going to have a new piece of equipment because that's so dangerous because that horse is only to put your hands on something with the horse facing this way, and this is all the wider it is. And it wasn't within months somebody had been working on this. That vaulting table came out, and now you can hit anywhere on it. I mean, there's a spring side of it, but it's much safer. They don't have the accidents that. I hate to tell you how many times I have just missed that horse. The coaches saved their lives. It makes me cringe when I think about it. We've had a few misses on that thing. So yeah, equipment became a problem because it's very expensive. A rail, when I started coaching, one of the rails on Unevens, I think a rail was $25 for a rail. No, they're 100 and something. Probably 200 and something. Plus, they went from wood to fiberglass.
Okay.
Because the wood would just, you know, if you did something on that bar and hit it just right, it's like a karate chop. Bang! You know, they had that happen a few times. So equipment changed because of safety. And the stuff that they're doing. But that's what the Olympics brings in. Okay? They bring that in. So, yeah.
Were there more female coaches hired after Title IX here that you know of, or was it tough to get more allotment for female coaches?
Well, the female coaches have pretty much stayed with the ones that we've had. But I think in the last years that since I've been retired, 7 years, Tom Pryor became the coach for men and women's swimming team. He did become the coach for that. We had a female diving coach, and then we had an Olympic diving champion. Bob Clotler was our diving coach for men and women because the teams became co-ed. It was easier to coach co-ed. Now we have a woman diving coach who's been here quite a while, Debbie. Basketball has stayed a woman. Volleyball has stayed a woman. Track and field, I think they got a man now doing track and field. When Title IX came in, Alice, by the way, when Title IX came in 73, Alice Ganzel then developed the women's cross-country team. She developed the women's cross-country team. And they've had a separate women's and men's cross-country team. And there was a reason for that, too, because the men's cross-country team, they had a lot of issues. They did the Water Street Run naked and all this stuff. Oh, I mean, it was. And once, and then that particular coach of that team now is no longer coaching.
Okay.
Boy, that just, it has just changed things.
Well,
you don't have control and you just think it's okay for your ass. We'd have a gymnastics meet here and we'd be in the other room there. I'd have the doors closed and we always served the judges a meal. We always did that. I've done that for years, especially if it was a long day. They had the meals in the coach's room. I walked in there one day during a meet, and here, I had shut the door. It was locked. Here, the cross-country team was in there eating all of the food. I walked in, and I said, "What in the world do you think you're doing here?" "Well, coach opened up the door and said we can eat." I go, "Oh, really?" I said, "Take what you got, walk out of here, and don't you come back." Well, then I talked to the that had to stop because that was ridiculous, and that was happening. I couldn't figure out what was happening. Well, I figured it out. Well, that coach was since let go. They just think, I don't think they gave the person a treasure, which is a good thing, you know. So, as far as men and women, we've always had a male hockey coach for the women. I mean, that's just that was there, you know. I don't know how many female hockey coaches there are, but I think we're going to see them though someday.
Yeah.
And, you know, you look at Stephanie Barnes, who is a national champion of pole vaulting. There's a woman who's she's made history in women's athletics at UW-Eau Claire. We never had a pole vaulting before. She's made history. So she's a pioneer. But she's a pioneer in the 2000s.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, yeah.
Somebody has to be the pioneer, you know. You know, and people think pioneer, they think of the old covered wagons. Well, sorry. So, yeah, that's all part of it. You have to grow. And as sports grow, a lot of things happen. You know, we had a synchronized swimming club here. Sandy Schumacher did it. I did it. And we dropped that, you know, after a while. I was doing the diving and the gymnastics, and after Title IX came in about 76, 77, I go, I can't be doing both, because I'd be coaching from 3 until 6 and then coaching diving till 8 o'clock at night and then come in for 8 o'clock classes in the morning. And that was part of those later years. It just got it was just too difficult. Plus all your responsibilities at TG and advising.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We all did advising. The men didn't have to. A lot of them didn't have to, because I don't want to do advise. I don't have to. Well, in 1991, when Paul Graber came here as our department chair, he wasn't here very long, and I walked in his office and I said, "I have a proposal to make. We take all of the advising away from all of the coaches." I says, "I'm going to take all of the advising away from the coaches, have a key advisor for elementary, have a key advisor for secondary, have a key advisor for exercise management, have a key advisor for PE minors." I said, "We need to do something, because," I says, "we've got people advising. They don't know their head from a hole in the ground. And it isn't fair to the students to have an advisor, and you're here for 5 years when you can do a program in 4. And that was the problem. So we took the key advising away from that, and I understand they're still doing that all. So, and I had 150 advisees a year at 150 in that exercise management program. So when I left coaching, I developed the exercise management, and I started working on that about 87, 88. I started doing the research to find companies that would have exercise management programs where they have fitness centers and they have health promotion and things like that. So by the time our first two, Christy Griggs and Nancy Potter, went out, we actually had to get permission for them to do their internship in the summer of 1990, because the degree wasn't official till fall of 1990. So they were the first two to graduate with the degree. So, yeah. So then that's what I did till I retired. I mean, I had a full-time job. I put students in internships all over the world, all over the country. 350 of them in 11 years.
That was for exercise management?
Yeah.
And
before I retired, then a couple of years, we had hired Don Breedle, And we got the exercise science going. He wanted to change everything. I said, you can't take the core courses, keep those in. We need something where they're strong in chemistry, and we need something strong in biology, because they needed those entities. And so all of a sudden we're getting chiropractic, and we have physical therapy, occupational therapy, pre-med. I mean, I have the students in exercise management. And then when I left, then now they're behavior, human performance. So they're all categorized kind of in that area. So, yeah, but somebody had to start it. Mm-hmm. And that's what you do. So, lots of growth. We have 500 majors here now. I had 150 in the program. They have 300 in the human performance area. And all. So it doubled. My position became 2.5 people. I knew I'd create a can of worms. I told that to the department. I says, we're going to open up a can of worms. He says, and don't be surprised, because it'll grow. There's just so many wonderful places and avenues they can go. And the senior citizens now that I'm working with, baby boomers are now coming in. Mm-hmm. 55 years old. I don't even 55 year olds coming into the senior center. Mm-hmm. And they're in great shape, moving well. You know? So, yeah.
And what year was exercise? That was
1990. Yeah. Now we are first ones out. So, yeah.
And you didn't work with gymnastics
after 1990? No, my doctor just, there's no way. I could hardly walk on the mats being gushy. Mm-hmm. and that didn't help me. Go to gymnastics and you'd have to sit down because you can hardly stand the pain, you know, and then you'd sit in the van going home and the burn would be so bad. Oh, I can't explain it. It was so awful. Those were very difficult years for me physically.
I guess I don't have much more unless there's something else that you'd like to tell me that.
Well, I made a copy of something for you. I just wrote something. But I went into the Women's Sports Foundation.
Okay.
That is an organization, mm-hmm. Women's Sports Foundation. Okay. And here's their Women's Sports Foundation. They talk about an executive summary here is of the 35th anniversary of Title IX. They've got samplings in here, so you might be able to find some information in there. For the 10-year, there's three, like 10 years, 738 NCAA institutions sample female participation grew by almost 26,000 athletes between 95 and 96. 2004-05, only 15% of an increase. So there's some history here, and you might be able to go in and even find more. You know, I did some digging. And then the National Association of Girls and Women's Sport and Women in Sports is what it's called now. That's another one that you can go into. But I just pulled this up and I thought, oh, I found this. I copied it up. I thought, well, this might give you some information on women, and it's called the Women's Sports Foundation. They've got some history in. The real beginning, though, was the National Association for Girls and Women's Sport, the NAGWS, when they held institutes. And I've got the book for the second year, and I've got the fifth one. And I know there's a first, third, fourth, and I think the fifth one might have been the last one. But that's how they brought us women in. Every state was represented in those, and then they had national champions at those institutes. It was wonderful. You know, they had people who were way, oh my God. You know, they had all of us diving, doing dives and stuff, but learning and how do you do a clinic and how do you set up a clinic. And then the responsibility was when you were given that institute, because the institute was free, you just had to get there. And with that institute, then we were committed for a year to do clinics. Oh, I did clinics all over the state of Minnesota in diving. And I hit the colleges first. And that was the purpose of those national institutes. I mean, they were wonderful. The first one, I know it was basketball and track and field. And then after that, they had the second one, second or third, or something like that, there was gymnastics, and we had kayaking. And, oh, my gosh. Well, that's how we got kayaking in the Olympics now, is because that's where it started. Okay. That's where it started. In fact, when I went to the one, it was in Michigan. Mickey King was an Olympic diver. She was our demonstrator. We had a chance to work with her and talk to her. And her coach was a guy that, when I was a kid, he was from Rochester, Minnesota. And I did Dick Kimball. I did diving shows with him. And he was an international diver. He never won the Olympics, though. But that guy... How many somersaults could he do off of a 30-foot tower from a mini tramp on the thing? Mm-hmm. Something like 4 or 5 somersaults. Drop it in the pool. Oh, my God. It was... So, yeah, I've met quite a few. In fact, Greg Louganis' diving coach. I met him, his diving coach, at Ron O'Brien. I think it's O'Brien. I met him at the Minneapolis Aquatennial that I was competing in. I beat his divers, but that's where I met him. You know, I met Ron O'Brien. So yeah, I've met a lot of. You know, I think I go back and when you call me, I go back and think, oh, geez, I really did meet a lot of very renowned people now. Because when I competed in nationals in 1962, Sammy Lee, who is now an Olympic diving coach. He's got all the big athletes. He was a young man. He was diving. And it's fun to watch the Olympics because Cindy Potter, and then her married name, I don't know what it is. She was 15 years old and she won the national diving championships that I competed in. She was just a kid. And now she's an announcer for him. You see. So, enough you. Yeah. Well, I don't know if this helps, but it's quite the little tape recording. Yeah.